I saw Bill there. I saw Annette there. I saw others. And I don't know if any of you noticed, but over in Lower Queen Anne, west of the Seattle Center, there's this blind man with this marvelous shepherd dog. He's probably one of the best trained seeing eye dogs. And I was pointing him out to some of my Jersey and Virginia friends, and he came walking across Mercer Street, walking east. And he got there to that light by the parking garage, and he was going to cross Mercer and go up the hill. And he's standing there waiting for the light. The dog lifted his leg and whizzed all over his pants. And my friend said, from Jersey, he says, "I thought you said that was a well-trained seeing eye dog." And I said, "Well, it is. It's probably one of the best." He said, "But did you see what he did?" And I said, "Yeah, I don't understand." And the blind man reaches in his pocket and gets some candy out. And he's reaching down. They're trying to find around, feel around. And my friend runs down and says, "Do you know what your dog did?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Why are you rewarding him?" And he said, "I'm not." He said, "I'm just trying to find his head so I can kick his bloody ass." You know, I don't know what kind of platitudes that I can say about our speaker. Practically everything pro and con has been mentioned over the years about him. There are many great stories about him, like, you know, when he got sober, it was an all-day, or maybe even more than an all-day trip by auto from Portland to Spokane, and you had to go up that Columbia River Gorge on those two-lane roads, and people would stop. AAers would stop coming out of Portland at White Swan because they knew they could stop at Shorty's and have a cup of coffee and talk AA, and here Shorty was out there in the middle of nowhere by himself, but still carrying on the tradition and the success of the AA story. He was an AA loner, even though he was in the state of Washington. And I got thinking, you know, he got sober in January, just after. Now, Myrtle, I don't know, Myrtle, if you even remember, because you're still out there having fun, when the Chicago Trib announced that night in November that Dewey had beat Harry Truman and then had to retract it. Well, shortly after then, our speaker got sober. Mon C. Waldron was the governor of this state, and in November of 1948, this state passed for the first time since Prohibition liquor by the drink over the bar, and it didn't take effect until 7 months after Shorty got sober, July the 1st, 1949. I pitched my first drunk in May of 1948, and by the time Shorty's getting sober, I'm a full-blown, late-stage, chronic alcoholic, and I'm not going to know that for 35 years later. But it had happened. I budded in June and bloomed by October. By November of 1948, I'm working in a sleazy nightclub with false ID on First Avenue, and there, not to cast any aspersions on anybody's ethnic background, but we had one of the greatest black jazz bands known to man on this West Coast, and they smoked reefers. Reefers. You would turn on and tune out, and let me tell you, I had on costumes, and I would do things that most you girls wouldn't do in some of the rigs I wore. I mean, this was we had one of the all-time best drag shows going. There were six of us, and we would get backstage at 6 o'clock in the evening and pass around a fifth of VO, smoke a reefer and take some speed and be ready at 9 o'clock for our first show. And if you can imagine the shape we were in by our third show at 12:30, because we drank in between. We were B girls or boys or whatever. We got paid for our drinks that we hustled between shows. And so here it is. Shorty's getting sober, and I had found the magic that made me somebody. I had found the thing that gave me the ability to go out there and be totally ridiculous and get paid for it. And I didn't know, as probably many of you didn't know, that if they had told me then, or even if they had told me 10 years or 15 years later, that I would end up drinking white port. Now, in case any of you don't know what white port is wine that has no grapes. They have one grape. Julius and Earl, I was down at the winery, they showed me this one grape on a string. And they said that they use it for every 10,000 gallons. They drop it in and out like this. And it creates Thunderbird. You know, I mean, that one grape does 10,000 gallons. And anyway, 15 years later, I'm a hopeless, helpless drunk, living on Skid Row, drinking wine, and I had gained by then the prerequisite for a membership in this program. I was consumed 24 hours a day with the idea to drink. Nothing else entered my mind. I can remember, oh, there was a gorgeous man. Oh, God, he was pretty. Almost as pretty as a guy that read What It Is, how, Dan is. He was walking along the street with his dolly on his arm. They were just a sashay in right down Washington Street, right down into the heart of Pioneer Square. And I'm coming up the other way, and I need a bottle of wine bad. I'm sick. I'm dying. I knew I'm dying. And I thought, there's no sense lying to this guy. He's going to say, you're lying. If I said, you know, my mother died in Arkansas and I need a dollar and a half to get there. Or I'm trying to feed my wife and 17 kids. Just give me a dollar and a half for a loaf of bread. And so I just said to him, I says, hey, man, I need a dollar and a half for wine or I'm going to die. And he says, what would you do for it? And I says, I think I'd do anything for it, man. And he said, would you get here right down here on your knees and bark like a dog? And I said, for a whole dollar and a half? He says, for a whole dollar and a half. I says, right. And down I am. I got my hands up and I go, arf, arf, arf. And he takes out a roll of money. He peels off two ones. He tips me, right? I'm so good. And sticks it in my mouth. And they go off laughing. And that wasn't humiliation enough to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to stay out another 4 or 5 years, see, battling this thing. And all this time, this old moss back puke in the Tri-Cities and white doesn't come over and save me, damn it. You know, he's sitting over there with more sobriety than dirt, you know. And I have to wait until 1979, August the 30th, God gave me my first day of sobriety, and I haven't had to pick up a drink or anything since then. And people said, are you bragging? And I say, no, my sponsor says if I don't mention my sobriety date, I probably don't have one, or if I do have one, I may be losing it. So I tell everybody I got sober, or I was given the first day. And about late in 1979, I happened to get over around the Tri-Cities, and I met this man. And I used to mention his name when I used his stuff. But I've used some of his stuff so much, I take it as my own these days. I don't think that's plagiarism, you know. And you know, one of the neatest things, I may be getting into his story, but one of the neatest things that he told me, well, he didn't tell me, he told the whole group meeting room there in Kennewick that happened to him in AA, and until he had talked about it, I didn't realize that's what happened to me. And we'll get into your story a little bit, but here's what he told me. Here's what he said that day. He said that all of his drinking life, everybody, his wife, his minister, priest, judges, everybody had told him all of the negative stuff that would happen to him if he didn't stop drinking. He said a priest or a minister told him, he said, Shorty, if you don't stop drinking the way you are, you're going to go to hell and burn for all eternity. He said his wife said, Shorty, if you don't stop drinking the way you're drinking, you're going to go and live on Skid Row and you're going to die down there all by yourself. Nobody's going to care. And he says, a judge told me, Shorty, if you don't stop drinking the way you're drinking, I'm going to put you in jail and throw away the key. Well, now, over the years, I've used that, and I talk about that. That's what they told me, you know, because I had people in my life that told me those same kind of things. And he says, but he come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said that the people sitting around when he got here, and like the people sitting around when I got here, instead of telling me all of the negative things that would happen if I didn't stop, they started telling me all the positive things that would happen when I did. And it's like Chuck C. says, it gave me a new pair of glasses, new lenses, because my focus shifted off of what would happen if I didn't stop to the beautiful and glorious things that could happen if I did. The other old moss back in my sobriety that was very monumental, and I'll quickly tell you about him, and he was another old puke when I got here with about 20 years or so, and he was, his name was Atheist John. I'd been sober about 7 months, and I know all about it now. You know, I'm well, right? And I'm sitting in one of these high-tone meetings one night, and I look around this crowd, and I make a decision, and I announce it to this group, and I postpone and throw out. I said, do you know there's not one son of a bitch in this crowd I'd get drunk with? And old Atheist John spoke right up, and he says, hey, boy, you've missed the point. You've missed the whole program. And I went, what? He said, you're not here to find people to get drunk with. You're here to find people to stay sober with. And I went, oh, really? You know? You know, that hadn't dawned on me, that I came here to meet the Annettes and the Dorothys and the Scotts and the Bill C's and the Johns and the Garys. Not to see who I get drunk with, but to stay sober with and maybe find some kind of a camaraderie and a love and a relationship that would be meaningful. Well, you know, I don't know. Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for me far better than I ever expected it to. And so I'm going to shut up. Unless he's in the middle of a miracle, and you don't know with Shorty, he may be, we may have a smoke break before dawn. If not, we won't. Because another thing I heard about him was that they said that when he first started speaking, people used to look at their watches. And by the time he had 5 years, they started looking at the calendar. And now that I hear it's over 40 years, we may be in for a petrified forest. So without any further ado, it's with great honor and great gratitude, not only to AA, but to a God of my understanding, that I would like to present to you Shorty H. from Kennewick.
How are you going to follow an act like that? I'm Shorty, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Shorty.
And this visit to this camp is a tremendous experience. I've never seen anything like it. And as hard as it is for me to get around, I've been able to get around so I can fully enjoy it. And you people have been very, very kind to me. I was a little worried when Annette called and said she wanted me to come here and talk at this, because I had talked in Port Angeles. And you know, I haven't got two stories. I only lived one life. And I have only lived at 81 years, and I would have to live a little bit longer in order to tell more of a story. I know there's speakers that have different stories for different, come back the second time, and then, but I don't consider myself on the speaker circuit. I'm just a person that's the assistant coffee maker of my grassroots group in Kennewick, Washington, holding down an important job, a job in service where it counts. Because, you see, I ensure that group they're going to have coffee. Because I come a half an hour early just in case the coffee maker doesn't get there. And I do that regularly. And I feel I'm being of service when I do it. Sometimes I feel I'm being of more service in some of these glamorous assignments that I've been given from time to time. I know I've been back to New York as a delegate. But I didn't see any new people coming seeking for help at the conference. I've been to PRASA many times. I didn't see any new person except once come asking for help. But boy, have I seen them come as my home group, coming asking for help and getting it. And to me, that's the most important function that I can perform, is to be with my home group regularly so they can depend on me. Because, as I'm going to tell you, somebody did it to me. Oh, you should know a little bit about, he tries to tell you something about me. He don't know about me. Not at all. You know, I traveled for a living after I got sober for a long while. I traveled and I sold athletic equipment for Bill Hatch Sporting Goods out of Spokane. I traveled the 9 states in the Northwest. That's when you didn't have them in every town. There were 11 of us on the road for Bill. And my first assignment was Wyoming. And I had just been back and I got to Casper. And I went there, they had a little stone block house they had built, a little group there, and it was 12 by 24, and it wasn't quite finished yet, but there was a car outside, and I went in there late in the afternoon, asked when there was going to be a meeting, and the lady says, it's going to be tonight. And she says, where are you from? And I told her, and she says, that's wonderful, I'm chairing tonight. Would you be able to talk a little bit? And I says, well, I could try. And so the evening come, and I went there, and I sold athletic equipment, of course. And she says, we have a stranger here. They didn't very often in those days have a newcomer come, and a traveling man. And she says, he's a traveling man from Spokane. And he works for Bill Hatch Sporting Goods. And he sells sporting house equipment. You younger folks, the older folks will explain that one to you. But he got a little mixed up. It was white salmon that I lived in, not white swan. And at the 10th anniversary of the Alano Club in Spokane, they invited me up there from White Salmon to speak. Now, in those days, we were very, very anonymous. And I have always been, but those days they were strict about it. And according to Identify, they give us little titles, and I was always Shorty of White Salmon. And whenever anything, well, it was Shorty of White Salmon. So this woman that was chairing got up there very nervously, and she says, our speaker for the 10th anniversary tonight is Whitey of Short Salmon. And it's kind of stuck with me ever since. A lot of people call me Whitey because of that. But in traveling, you still have your family to think of, and I'd gotten back with my family, and I'd been out for 5 weeks. I'd been over in Wyoming, and I was coming home, and it was late Friday afternoon, and three of our daughters were in high school, and I knew there'd be a lot of problems I would have to solve for them during the 3 days I was going to be home and take care of the important things around. And I prepared myself for it. And I walked up to the house and took my suitcase and my briefcase in and set it down on the living room floor. And there right in front of me was a brand new sewing machine. And I says, who's that? He says, it's ours. I says, "Who's ours?" "Oh, the girls and me." "Where do you get it?" "We bought it." "How come I didn't know anything about it?" They just shrugged their shoulders. I went and sat down and I said, "Once and for all, we're going to settle a question around here. We're going to find out who's boss." And my wife looked at me and says, "Shorty, you'd be a lot happier if you never found out." Well, I drank myself into AA. When I was a senior in high school, we went to the picnic, three of us, with a pint of pure drugstore alcohol and two quarts of mix. And we stopped outside the picnic grounds. We didn't dare go in with it. And we slugged ourselves a few times and then stashed it by a telephone pole. Went inside and played softball with people, and one of us would sneak out and help himself to some more. Three of us would go out and drink some more. The other guy would keep sneaking back for more. And then it wasn't noon until he passed out. Well, the next thing he remembers, he was sitting in the superintendent of school's office the next morning with his dad. And the superintendent was having an awful time deciding whether or not he should be permitted to graduate. But fortunately, my father was a pretty fast talker, and I was allowed to graduate. But that wasn't the really tough part of it. My dad, in that little bitty community, was the Methodist minister. And I was the youngest son of 10 children. And he wasn't the kind of Methodist minister as you said. He was a real old-fashioned Methodist minister. And of course, it was quite a scandal that his son should done what he did. But you know, being in a minister's family was to me quite an experience, because we couldn't eat breakfast in the morning unless we listened to my dad read one chapter out of the Bible and get us all on our knees and pray. And my mother and him would pray, and sometimes my older sisters. And then we could have breakfast. And the night before we went to bed, the same thing. Every morning, every night. And me and my brother next to 2 years older than my, our knees would get so sore down there waiting for them all to get done praying. We just hated it. And then we'd have to go to church three times on Sunday, and we had to go to a prayer meeting on Thursday night. But that wasn't the worst of it. Three of us boys, were better than average athletes. And in a small community, three good athletes are on call, I want to tell you. But there was a handicap with us three. We could be on the high school and the grade school teams, and they finished things on Friday. But we couldn't be on any of the other sports because it was a sin to play ball on Sunday. And in those days, you had a 6-day work week. You didn't have a 5-day work week. So the only time you could play would be have games was Sunday. But we couldn't play because that was a sin. And of course, if you sinned, you didn't get to go to heaven. And we couldn't go to shows because that's a sin. And you wouldn't go to heaven then either. We couldn't play cards with our friends. We couldn't go to dances. It seemed that everything that we wanted to do and it was fun to do was a sin. We didn't like it very well. I didn't. And then the reward was kind of confusing, because if we did all this and we died, we'd get to go to heaven. And what do you think they were going to let us do in heaven? They were going to let us walk the golden streets. And I began figuring that thing out. That's quite a price to pay just to have the privilege of walking golden streets. And so I kind of within myself, when I got 12, 13 years old, started thinking of ways I was going to get away from this religious bit. And so when I could get away from it, I really got away from it. I made a vow that I wouldn't have anything to do with this God business. I wouldn't have anything to do with this church business. I wouldn't have anything to do with any of that stuff. And I did it. Except once in a while, there'd be a girlfriend that belonged to some church, and I'd fake it for the evening or something when I went with her to some of her events. Otherwise, I wouldn't have anything to do with church. I got out in this world, and of course, I started drinking. And it got to a point where it was a regular thing I did. Every Tuesday night after payday, I worked in St. Paul. I'd go down on the Mississippi River, just four blocks away in a houseboat owned by a guy named Jess, and he made beer, and he made home brew, and he made wine, and he sold it to young people only. And I'd go down there, and pretty soon it got so bad I was spending my whole paycheck. And I was getting into trouble. And I got canned because bill collectors were after me so bad. And I didn't know then what I know about alcohol. Now I'd known that was one of the first signs of being an alcoholic. And that was that I was taking care of my wants before my needs. I wanted to drink, but I needed to pay my rent. I needed to pay my clothing bill. I needed to pay my meal ticket. But I took care of my drinking first. And I got canned for it. Another time I got canned because I didn't know how to catch up on my bills again. I was afraid it was going to happen. And I did a little stealing and I got caught. In those days, you didn't have all these organizations who's going to prove that you weren't at fault for doing something wrong, that it was something in your makeup, your chemical makeup, or your ancestry or something. And they just took you, you did it. And you had to pay for it. I didn't have to go to jail, but I had to make, I would guess it was about four times the restitution of what I took. But I got canned again, of course. And there again, when we steal in order to drink, we got a monkey on our back. There's no question about it. But it went on. I got married. We had some children. And I got various jobs. I didn't have too much trouble getting work. I was a very capable person. And I got mixed up with the radio station WCCO in Minneapolis. We lived in Minneapolis then. And they had a Monday night political half hour. Max Carl was in charge of it way back then. And I got the job of going around and taking the pulse in the state of the various areas of how they felt about the various candidates. Like these, what they do now on a big scale. I just did. They sent me out. They paid my expenses and paid me for it. I'd go out usually on Friday and Saturday and be back Monday morning with a report so he could broadcast on Monday night. And I do this, and that was enough to get by. We did get by, not too good. I drink most of it up. But I did various things. I played ball on a little semi-pro basketball team that barnstormed around for a while, made good money. And I got involved in politics. I got really acquainted with all phases of the politics in Minnesota, and the Farm Labor Party was in control, and they had made a mess of things, and there was a great agitation to get a change. And 17 of us guys went down to Hastings, Minnesota, and we talked a guy into filing for governor, and he won. And we were his committee. His name was Harold Stassen. And he gave me a very fine job. Best job I've ever had. And I knew I couldn't drink on the job. Harold didn't drink at all. He'd lost one lung through tuberculosis. He wasn't an anti-pro or anything, but he just, you didn't drink around today. In the evening, okay. But Julie Sletton, the highway commissioner, and I, we loved to drink, and we'd done a lot of drinking, and he also was a minister's son, only a Lutheran minister's son. And we had a lot of things in common, and we wouldn't drink during the day, but at 4:30 in the afternoon, we'd beat it across the parking lot to the Capitol Tavern, and we'd start drinking, and that became increasingly worse and worse. And of course, I became increasingly less efficient in my job. And it became increasing in the number of times I had to have my wife call up and say I couldn't show up that day because I had to take somebody to the dentist or I had the flu or something like that. And that pile of portfolios, which I distributed to the proper legislator so that the governor could get his various things through best, I had to have those distributed each day. But I didn't get it, and the pile got bigger and bigger. And the pile was about 2 days behind when the governor came in and said, "Shorty, I want to see you in my office." And so I arranged to go to his office. And he said, "Shorty, you don't want any argument. I'm going to tell you one thing. You got a problem. And I've arranged for you to go to Miller Hospital. under the disguise of nervous exhaustion, because you couldn't say alcohol in those days, so they wouldn't take in. And he says, we'll pay it for it out of our contingent fund. And he says, you either do that or resign. Well, a beautiful job that I had, and then the depression was just starting to get over. I wasn't going to resign. I was going to the hospital, and I went right to the hospital. They took me. And I was to be there for 30 days. At the end of 25 days, they decided they'd done wonderfully by me in the head, because I was eating good. Everybody treated me swell. Psychiatrists, I drove them a little crazy, but then clergymen all seemed to come in there and want to talk to me about my drinking. You can be sure my wife came over and talked to me a few times about my drinking. And one evening, the doc says, well, you don't have to stay here 30 days. I think it was 25th, 26th day. He says, we're going to let you out 10 o'clock in the morning. So 10 o'clock the next morning, I go out to my car in the parking lot, climb in it. And they did such a thorough job on me that I never took another drink until 2 o'clock that afternoon. And I got stinko, and I had to resign. And then's when things started going downhill. Then's when I started to realize that I wasn't getting canned from these little jobs I got for drinking. I was getting canned because of my efficiency. My ability to do a good day's work had slipped by me. And that would depress me, and I'd have to drink. And I got to a point where I'd have the DTs and the shakes and seizures. And I got connected with a couple of smart boys that did a lot of drinking and said I didn't have to have them. All I had to do was keep a little alcohol in my system all the time, and I wouldn't have the DTs or seizure, which is true. I wouldn't have the withdrawals. And it worked. And then I got to a point where I was afraid not to drink. And I was afraid for two reasons. It was the DTs and shakes, but it was also because I wasn't earning money very often. I wasn't supporting my family at all. And it was tough around home. And finally, it came to a point where I used to say that my family decided they could live without me. But you know, I didn't change that story till I was 20 years on the program. I didn't have the guts to change it, because the fact of the matter was I walked out on my family, a wife and seven children, without any visible means of support. We had at that time ended up in Spokane, because I got transferred by DuPont to Richland and Hanford Engineering Works, and then we went from there up to Spokane. And by that time I was able to tell, then I've been able to tell the truth. I deserted my family. And so I went over to Seattle, tried to find somebody that understood my drinking, and I ended up in San Francisco. I bummed my way. It was the fall of the year, and I was scared that I'd get caught up north in the winter, and I wanted to be down where it was warm. And I bummed and hiked and got odd jobs and stuff so that I had something, a little to eat and something to drink, and I finally ended up in San Francisco on Skid Row. I'm not going to the end of all the details of what we did on Skid Row, except that you have to learn certain things on Skid Row in order to exist without an income. You have to learn how to mooch and beg and score, and you have to learn how to keep out of the road of the paddy wagon so it doesn't pick you up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and throw you in the drunk tank. And you have to learn just what to do the day before so you can sell a pint of blood for $5 at the blood bank, which you could do every 2 weeks if you pass the test. And you even learn how to fix a cardboard box, a great big one that some refrigerator or something came in, and you drug it under the Bay Bridge, and you stuffed it full of newspapers, and you crawled in and tipped it up so the open end was up under the bridge, the rain wouldn't come down. And you'd sleep in that at night, almost as uncomfortable as this bunk was last night. And that's the way we got by, except I got locked up in the drunk tank one night, and that was good. That was good for me, but boy, I hated it. I didn't know at that time it was good for me. Boy, that drunk tank was an experience you can't believe. When you can pile men together so they haven't any room to lay down, they can sit down on that cement floor, or they can stand beside each other, and they're all in there the same reason they drank too much, and they've all been deprived of something to drink for a couple of hours, and that famous illness attacks them, called puking. and you've got a mess on your hands. You've got an unbelievable mess on your hands. And it's so long till morning. And then when morning comes, the judge doesn't take you to his chamber. He stands out there and calls off your name. And when he found out I was out of town, he'd give me 24 hours to leave town, which I didn't do. But that was the catalyst that led me to AA. Because I sat on a barrel, a garbage barrel on 3rd and Minna Street, which is a block off 3rd and Howard, south of Market. The worst hell hole they're supposed to be in Skid Row. And I sat on that garbage can, and I still remember it had a handle on it, and part of me sat on the handle and it wasn't very comfortable. You know, I can still remember that. But I knew one thing for sure, that I either had to get rid of my drinking or I had to get rid of myself, because I could not stand another night in the drunk tank. And so I started thinking about it, and I thought of the time that the psychiatrist worked on me for 5 sessions until I made his life unmanageable. And that didn't work. And I thought of the time the doctor told me my kidneys and my liver are starting to get touched by the booze, and if I don't quit drinking, pretty soon I'll be a goner. And that got me so scared, I went up the street a ways and drank a little bit to get rid of my fright. And my wife asked me to go see a minister, and he had me kneel in prayer with him. And he prayed, and he prayed, and he asked me if I'd pray, and I didn't know. Finally, he got me up, and my knees were so sore, I could hardly get up. And he says, "We'll try this again sometime." And I walked down the street 2 blocks, got something to drink to ease the pain in my knees. And I took a little liquor cure. They called it the Murray Liquor Cure in Minneapolis. And I don't know whether you paid $400 for 3 days or $300 for 4 days at that time, because I didn't pay for it. A fellow paid for it for me that wanted me to work in the outfit he was, but he wanted me to quit drinking. And they give me the aversion cure, of course, where you get so sick with drinking that you're supposed to rebel against it, even the smell of it, for the rest of your life. And the doctor told me that. He told me how embarrassed I'd be if I even went into a beer joint or cocktail lounge. And I had 2 of the terribly miserable days. God, no drink. I didn't know how to do anything without drinking. Here I was designed, to not drink. And I just couldn't stand it. There's just no possible way of me doing this. And I thought, well, maybe it's important that I get a second opinion. And I did. I went and got a 1/2 pint of bourbon. And I went into an alley by a great big telephone pole that had these iron peg steps. First one was about that high. And I opened this 1/2 pint and I threw 1/2 of it down, holding on to it. Sure enough, they were right. I threw up. Oh, how I threw up. And I looked at that 1/2 pint and I resigned myself to forever not drink anymore. And if I was going to have a life of no drinking anymore, I better have a good one to finish this. And so I threw the other 1/2 down. And I held onto that peg and I held onto that peg. What do you know? That doctor lied. I didn't throw it up. Here I could drink again. And I was happy. And I kept on drinking. And so I decided that there was no hope for me. So I was going to jump off the Bay Bridge. The Bay Bridge is 7 miles long, as you know. The ramps are 2 miles uphill to get up on the ramp above the water, and nobody's going to jump if they don't get over the water, because you might hurt yourself if you don't get over the water. And I knew I couldn't walk those 2 miles uphill in the condition I was that morning. So I went out and started scoring for drinks. And by the time I had enough under my belt so I thought I could do it, it was too late in the day, so I postponed it. I did that for 3 days. Might have been 4, might have been 2, but I did it several times. One morning I had 40 cents in my pocket. Where I got them, I don't know. But I'm standing there on Embarcadero. And I'm looking at that ramp, and all of a sudden I know I can make it. I got 40 cents. And 40 cents, shot, good shots at the right place, and I knew the right place. It was just across a little ways. You could get two big shots, and you'd have a dime over. And usually the bartender would give you a third one for that dime. And I knew with three big shots I could make it. And I felt pretty good about it. And I went over there. I was about to go in, and the guy got in my road, and I bumped into him. And he turned me around and said, "You drink too much." He was all dressed up. He didn't belong down there at all. Big guy. And so I looked at him, and I said, "Who the hell doesn't know that?" And he said, "Would you like to be sober?" And I says, "Anybody'd like to be sober." He says, "I didn't ask you that. I asked you if you'd like to be sober." I says, "I'm one of those that don't get sober. I didn't even ask you if you thought you could get sober." I got kind of mad, and I says, "Who are they, Salvation Army or somebody?" And he says, "No." I and a couple of my buddies over in this little coffee shop, they are. We're down here looking over the old homestead. And I must have looked just about like you look now. And I found out I didn't have to drink anymore. Would you like to hear about it? Well, Providence must have stepped in, because I had always revolted at any suggestions about my drinking. But you know, I walked with him into that coffee shop, and I sat down with those three guys, and I listened to them. And they figured out a way whereby I could be in a flop house for a few days while I got awful sick from stopping. And they told me I'd be sick. But they told me, "You didn't taper off. We'll be with you." And they were. And after 2 days, they took me to an AA meeting. They drove me. I didn't know where I was. They drove me to the basement of the French Catholic Church on Bush Street, San Francisco. And I went in there. And after the meeting, no sooner got started than I knew I was in the wrong place. I'd been suckered into another religious organization. You know what they did? They opened with a prayer. What the hell good's a prayer going to do? I've tried that. And so I was sitting there mad. I wished I could have left, but I didn't know where I was. And I knew I had a cot to sleep in if they'd take me back to it. So I had to sit through the meeting. And I sat through the meeting, and I'd get mad. Somebody'd say something about a God, and another one say something about spiritual. And then to top it all off, they closed with the Serenity Prayer. And boy, I was ready to go. But then again, something happened. These three guys come over to me. And I said, "Shorty, we'd like to have you go down to our little club down at the end of Bush Street here, down your main drag there, and have some coffee with us." And I thought, what does he want to do that for? I haven't got anything. And then I like to call it Providence. I use the word often. Providence made me realize that here were three guys that really cared about me, unselfishly cared. One of the greatest weapons we've got in AA today is that we care. We share because we care. And they showed me they cared, and they took me down there, and afterwards they took me back to that little flop house, and they said they'd pick me, one of them picked me up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and that was the start. He left me off at the club that night at 4 o'clock, and it got to be about 6, and one of the guys said, "Do you want a sandwich, Shorty?" And, oh, I don't know if anyone will. Hell, I was hungry and didn't have any money, but I took it. My pride got lowered a notch or two, and I ate a sandwich with him, and who became my sponsor, this Jack Irving, he came up there and sat at a table, and he came over to me and says, "There's a meeting we can go to tonight." And I says, "Okay." And so I went with him to a meeting. And after the meeting, he said to me, he says, "I'm your sponsor." And I says, "What the hell's a sponsor?" And he says, "You'll soon find out." He was a tough, hard-boiled used car salesman. And he says, "Now I got some rules. It's only suggestions." He says, "Well, if the suggestion was that you come to the AA program, the rules are what I'm going to have you do if I'm your sponsor. And if you don't like it, get another sponsor." And I says, "All right, what are they?" He says, "First, you're going to call me every night at 6 o'clock for the next 30 days. You can get a free phone at the club. All I want to know is that you're all right. If I'm not home, my wife Ada will answer, and you just tell her you're okay. If you're not okay, if you got a problem, just spit it out, and we'll take care of it right away for you. And he says, the second email, you got to be to at least one meeting a week with me. I got to see and hear how you're doing. And he says, I go to two meetings a week. And you can come to both of them, I'd like, but you got to at least be to one of them. That's all there's to it. You've got to be to one of those meetings so I can hear and see you. Third thing is you're going to have to read the big book called Alcoholic Anonymous. And we don't give you a big book. You can borrow one or go down to the club and read one, because when we give you books, we find out you don't put much value to them. But boy, if you buy it out of your first paycheck, you're going to crack the cover. But you won't be without the ability to read one until that time comes. And he says, then you're going to have to be of service. I says, wait, I ain't got a job. I got nothing. What can I be of service? He says, you can stack those 40 chairs that have to be stacked after the meeting neatly. It's an agreement we have with the Catholic Church that we'll stack them in a neat pile in the corner. And that's your first job in service, is to stack chairs. And so we got along, and I kept asking, telling him, and he says, now you're not going to talk for 30 days at a meeting. He says, because all you can talk about is your problems. And an AA meeting is the place where you hear or you talk about solutions. You talk your problems over with me, and when one of those problems has been solved, then you can talk at the meeting and tell them how you solved your problem. And you know, they did that in those days. And so I sat there. It was tough. But I wasn't allowed to talk for 30 days. And I started working the steps with him. And I started trying to do some things. And it was confusing. And a lot of it was very confusing. It seemed to be they were mixing religion up with it and all that stuff. And I had trouble. But I had trouble getting a job. Now, it wasn't that there wasn't work. If there wasn't work commensurate with my great ability. That was, I thought I had a right, now I was sober, to have a good job. And I wasn't getting one. And I was turning down little menial tasks. And I was going hungry. And there'd be times when I couldn't pay room rent. And I'd walk the Market Street window shopping all night long. And then at 6 o'clock in the morning, I knew a place where I could go and get free coffee and some week-old donuts. But then finally, up at the club, a guy came up 11 o'clock one morning. He was the chef at the Golden Pheasant in San Francisco, a prestigious eating place. He says, got a job, Shorty? I said, nope. You got one now. I said, doing what? Washing dishes. I said, to hell with you. He says, no, Shorty, you're going to take it. He says, it's only a part-time job. It only pays $22.50 a week. You work 2 hours, 5 days a week. And you get one good full meal all 7 days. Well, that one good meal each day, I had to give in. And I went down and I washed dishes. And I felt so menial. And I was afraid to even have people see me go in and out the employee's door, for afraid they'd guess I was a dishwasher. And I went down there and I worked at it and I hated every minute of it. But I got my first paycheck, and $22, and I took it up to the club because I'd promised the guy that he borrowed me a dollar. And I says, before I spend the first buck of it, you're going to get your buck back. And I kept my promise. I went up there to give him his dollar back, and there's my sponsor sitting at a coffee table. He says, what do you got? I says, I got paid. He come over and he took $3.50 from me and bought a big book. Boy, I'll tell you, I had the world's meanest sponsor. There's no question. Then he grabs me by the arm and he takes me and sets me down in a Davenport. And he says, now I'm going to show you how to read it. Now, you read all this book. But start with, I've had experiences that make it very advisable to me that you do it this way. Now, I want you to read the preface. And I want you to read Doctor's description of what an alcoholic is. I want you to get that in your belt. I want you to read the rest of it, but just for the time being, I want you to skip to chapter 5. I want you to get started on the program. And I want you to promise me. And I says, promise what? He says, none of your business, just promise me. I says, okay. So I promised, and he says, now for 15 nights in a row, before you go to sleep, you're going to open that book to chapter 5 and read those first 2.5 pages slowly out loud to yourself so that you both see them and hear them. And you're going to do that 15 nights in a row, and don't bellyache about it because it's tough, but you're going to do it and you'll be glad you did it. Well, I did it for 3 nights, and the 4th night I got home, I'd been playing pinochle with the guys up at the club till late, and I thought, I'm too tired, and so I lay down. Couldn't go to sleep, kind of like last night. And I finally I reached up and got the book, turned the light on. I read it slowly out loud, put it back, went to sleep. And for the next couple, 3 nights, I did it so I was sure to go to sleep. Not for any value I got out of it. But you know something? Words started jumping out of me. He'd gotten me a dictionary. He says, you can't understand the program without a dictionary. And he got me a dictionary. And I started, those words started jumping out. And I could remember the first thing I realized was the first sentence went clear across the page. It isn't, rarely does a person fail, period. You know how we are. We start reading a paragraph and then we think what the rest of it's going to say, so we just jump to the next paragraph. But it said, who has thoroughly followed our path? And I began thinking about that. How thorough am I? And then it went a little in and said, if you have the capacity to be honest. Well, I was pretty much of a liar, con artist. I didn't have any honesty in my system. Maybe I don't belong on the program. It says you have to have the capacity to be honest. I don't know if I got it or not. I don't think I have. And that, I went to Dr. Poliak over at the psychopathic ward of the San Francisco Hospital, who was a very good friend of AA's. You read about him in AA Comes of Age. And I caught him in the hall, and I says, can I have a minute, doctor? He said, yeah, Shorty. I says, what does capacity to be honest mean? He says, you worried about it? I said, yes. He says, you don't have to be. 9,999 out of 10,000 have the capacity to be honest. I says, but what does it mean? He says, it just simply means you know the difference between right and wrong. If you know the difference between right and wrong, you have the capacity to put it be honest. And I did. I knew the difference between right and wrong. And then, as I was walking back, a picture of me as a little boy, when my dad, we had a small farm to supplement our income, and we had a little old Fordson tractor, and there were 3 barrels under a tree. One said oil, one said kerosene, the other said gasoline. But the gasoline one said capacity, 55 gallons. And I began thinking about that. It always said capacity 55 gallons. It even had the capacity of 55 gallons when it was empty. Capacity had nothing to do with quantity. Capacity had to do with what it could hold. It was a place to put 55 gallons. If I knew the difference between right and wrong, I had the place to put honesty if I should ever achieve it. And that made sense to me. And I kept going through that, and I come to this word, rigorous honesty. And I was thinking, you know, Bill always wanted to say absolute. And I think rigorous honesty, rigorous honesty. I can't be perfect. And so I looked that up in the dictionary. And I found out it meant doing your very best. Well, I could do my very best. It wasn't going to be very good. But all I had to do is be sure it was my best. And that helped me. And then I come down to where it said, get rid of your old ideas. I didn't have any old ideas. All these guys had to do to keep me sober was find me a good job and a nice car to drive and some change of clothes and get my family back. I wouldn't drink anymore. Well, that had happened time after time. And I realized that I had to get rid of old idea. I had to get rid of that old idea that these material things were going to get me sober. And then I come up with that word spiritual, and I went around and asked 3 different guys to define spiritual. I got three different definitions, and so I went to the dictionary again. And to make a long story short, I looked it up in 22 different dictionaries in the San Francisco Library. And in all of them, there were seven of them that had a sentence in that really caught my eye. And I believe to this day, it said, all things that are not material are spiritual. And I bought it. And I started walking down to the club from the library, about 20 blocks. And I started thinking of things they were asking me to do. They were asking to be honest. Well, that wasn't a material act. That had to be spiritual. They were asking me to be tolerant. That'd go in the spiritual pile too. They were asking me to care about other people, quit being indifferent. That went in the spiritual pile. They asked me all, quit having resentments. And that went in the spiritual pile. All the things they were telling me I should do in AA in order not to drink again went in the spiritual pile. I didn't have a single stick in that material pile. And so it helped me with my understanding of the spiritual. I got that. And then I got up to the third. I got the first and second step. Oh, it said power greater than yourself. It didn't say a higher power, because that would have chased me off. I'd have thought that God in heaven that they'd always been talking about. But they told me a power greater than myself, and it could start out with the three guys that were helping me, and it would grow, which it did. I got that third step, and I was having trouble. I didn't understand God. I could not comprehend a person that had showed me. Now, I don't say this is so, but to me, I believe had a Jekyll and Hyde character. I felt that. He was ready to burn me in hell at one time and send me to heaven in another. And I just couldn't understand that God. And I had prayed and prayed and prayed, and look where I ended up in Skid Row. No, I don't understand God. And some were telling me you got to understand, have God, or you can't make the program. But I had the fortune of running into Jim Burwell, the seventh man on the program, the guy that said to made Bill put "as I understand it" after God. He fought with him, not physically, but verbally. They had terrible fights before Bill had give in to that. And I met him in Rosemont when he was over to see his friend Floyd Bowers, one of the first men in AA in California. We drove over there, three of us. And I told him about this. He says, well, there's something a lot of people don't understand about this program. You know, we made Bill write those steps of what we had done to get sober. Why don't you read them as something you're going to have to do in order to stay sober? Put it in the present tense. Well, I went home and I took the book out and I got to the third step. And I thought of myself what I was going to do. I was going to have to make a decision that I'd turn my will and my life over to the care of God when I understood Him. Well, the word decision isn't a word of action. That's a word of intent. All right, Shorty, are you willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God that you learned to understand? I said, yeah, I'm willing to do that if they can wait till I have an understanding. And it practically tells me that. And I accepted that. I've been comfortable with it all my life. And eventually the program's big enough to give me a God I understand. Don't think the program can't do it. And then that I had to go to the dictionary for the fourth step. People were saying, you got to spill your guts. You got to spill your guts. You got to tell everything you've done since you were in diapers. An autobiography. One of the greatest misery makers you can name. I've had people come to me so depressed from trying to have a counselor get them to be sure everything is in there. I tore up one of over 70 pages of one guy that hadn't slept for four nights because his counselor for the fourth time says, try once more so we're sure it's complete. And I tore it up and sold him a bill of goods that kept him sober from then till now. This is not a backward-looking program. It's a forward-looking program. It says take a moral inventory. And inventory means what you have on hand. And morals means your character. Get a dictionary. Means your character. And character will tell you it's the principles you practice in living. Okay, my sponsor and I went to work on that. What principles am I practicing in living? I'm practicing lying and cheating, resentment, indifference, procrastination. All right. That's what I was going to have to take care of. That was the things I was going to have to get rid of in order to stay sober. And the beautiful part of it was I started to realize I didn't have to get rid of those. The lying and the cheating and the con artists and the indifference and the never getting things done in time and stalling and lying. They left me like a rat leaves a drowning ship. They can't live around honesty. They can't live around tolerance. They disappear by themselves. They just are not there. And so the program doesn't even give you the job to get rid of your defects of character and shortcomings. They leave. They just run. If you'll be honest to the best of your ability. And then I thought, well, now this thing has got so great. This asking me, and I'm all for it, but boy, I'm not going to be perfect. And then I read where it said, no one among us are perfect. And that was well. And then I read the definition of practice. And the definition of practice in the dictionary was an earnest desire to improve oneself. Didn't say one word about being perfect, just to improve yourself. And so I started telling the truth, and I practiced it, lousy as it was. I did the best I could. And I found out that's all the program asked me to do was my best. No, it didn't make any difference how lousy it is as long as it was my best. And I practiced it. Perfection never came into the picture at all. And I went through those steps. My fifth step took care of the things in the past that's essential. The exact nature of my wrongs. Not the time I beat the bartender out of 2 bits and stuff like that. And stole somebody's change that they left when they went to the head. And it was people where I'd done things that harmed people. And I got to take care of that in the fifth step. And I went on. I better tell you about the job I had. Somebody asked me if I'd tell today, asked me if I'd tell about my first job as a dishwasher. After washing dishes for 2 weeks, I went up to Chellis Carpenter, who was dead now. He became a judge down in San Francisco. He was 3 years on the program, and I barged up into his office, and his secretary let me in. And she said, what's the matter, Shorty? I said, Chellis, this program isn't worth nothing. I go to meetings as often as they hold them, and I'm not getting any place. He says, what are you doing? He says, I'm a lousy, stinking dishwasher, part-time. He says, Shorty, how good a dishwasher are you? I says, what do you mean, how good a dishwasher am I? I mean it. Because I'm going to tell you something, and you better remember it all your life. Until you become the best dishwasher they ever had, you've got no right to expect you were capable of doing anything better. And I've practiced that ever since, and it works. It isn't whether I like what I'm doing or not. It's whether I'm fulfilling my promise to my employer to the best of my ability. And it was about 3 weeks, I'm at a job paying me at that time tremendous wages, $400 a month. At Hastings Clothes, one of the prestigious clothing stores in San Francisco. And out of the 35 extras they hired to take care of the 2 week sale they had before they moved to their new quarters, I was the only one they kept for steady. And the reason was I was the best extra among all 35. I picked up after myself. I straightened the sleeves on the suits, and I saw that the pants matched the coat before it was hung up. I did all those things that you do if you're going to do it right. And they kept me. And I worked there until a bonding company accused me of stealing $52,000 from a past employer of mine. And they had to let me go. Which was proved I didn't do. It's a long story, but I didn't do it. But he thought he had a chance. He thought I'd never sober up and they'd never find me. Well, I got up into the steps and I kept reading the book. And I got to the 11th step. And the 11th step taught through prayer and meditation to improve my contact with God as I understand Him. Praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. Then came the time I understood my God and my God's will for me. My God's will for me was that I practice these principles in all my affairs to the best of my ability. And to the extent I practice them, to that extent I'll have it good. And it's proven itself down through the years. And I've had a lot of fun in AA for it. When I became the chairman of the Washington area, well, I had heard a man when I'd been sober just a few weeks that was supposed to be the pillar of AA. And boy, what a talk he made. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if I could be a pillar in AA? And so I became a chairman of Washington area. And I was driving home from Wenatchee to White Salmon, and I thought, Shorty, you finally become a pillar in AA. You're chairman. Chairman, this whole big area. But you know, sanity returns occasionally. Providence sees to it. And sanity returned, and I realized that maybe AA would survive without area chairman. And then, lo and behold, I was selected as a delegate. 91 of them in the North American continent. I'm one of the 91. And I'm driving home again, but I'm from Spokane this time, and I lived in Kennewick. Before I got to Kennewick, I realized that maybe, if such a thing, heaven forbid, but if such a thing should happen, that there would be no delegates, AA possibly wouldn't collapse. So I'd have a little farther to go. And so I'm driving up the Yakima River. And I get to a little town of Wapato. And I heard about a little guy named Harry, a little Indian fellow. He held a meeting every Sunday night at 8 o'clock in a little storefront along the railroad tracks. And I knew I was on my way to Yakima, and I said, just about 8, I'll stop and see their little group. And I stopped. There's one car in front and a light in the window. And I went in, stuck my head in the door. I said, hi, Harry. He said, hi, Shorts. I says, am I early? He says, no. I stepped in. I says, you mean, if I hadn't come, you'd be alone? Yeah. Does it happen often? Oh, yeah, quite often. And there he was, sitting behind the desk, all dressed immaculately. He was a heavy-set guy, short guy. And he had a percolator of coffee, and he had cups, and he had a dozen donuts, and he had the literature in front of him. He had 4 chairs there for people if they came. So I sat there, and I says, Harry, I says, how long have you been sober? He says, 9 years. I says, you come down here every Sunday night? Yep. How many Indians have come in to you? He's 5. Didn't say sober, but they come and talk to me about it. I says, why do you do it, Harry? He says, the book says that you've got to keep it available. And this is the only way I know how. I finally met a pillar in AA. Thank you.
Thank you, Shorty. Before we close, I've lost a lid, and I don't mean one in a Glad bag. No, some are...